Welcome to Watching Silent Films. My name is Yifong, and with me is Lily.
Hey, Fong, what's going on?
Hey, what's going on? How have you been?
Good. I was just saying earlier, I did a film shoot last night and I got home at 3 a.m. this morning. So even though I had a nice nap, I'm still super tired.
That's okay. That just means that if you're incoherent somehow, we'll understand why.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, it's not the movie, right? It's just you're tired. So today, and what we're gonna do on Watching Silent Films is we'll pick a feature or a series of shorts and watch it and talk about it. That's what we do on this podcast. And this week, we're gonna talk about D.W. Griffith's Intolerance from 1916, his follow-up to, of course, The Birth of a Nation. Before we get to that, did you happen to have a chance to watch anything in the classics, realm, just in general? If not, that's okay.
I'm trying to think. I feel like I did, but I probably didn't, and my mind is just telling me I did because I was
You
thinking,
mentioned
didn't
something last week, so you might be thinking
yeah.
about that. Some silent movie you already seen last week.
I know, Love's Labour's Lost. I'm thinking that's like some Shakespeare play. It was like when the world stood still. But yeah, I watched that the week before, so for I have not watched anything new this week just because I was kind of busy and but hey, there's plenty of silent films. I was talking to a couple people last night about some silent films and saying how, good they actually can be. So that's a plus.
That's cool. Yeah, you're doing right by silent films then. I hadn't really seen a lot of old silent film classics, but I have recently been going through this filmmaker, Hong Kong filmmaker, Wong Kar-wai's filmography. I think I mentioned it before. So I just finished, what did I finish? 2046, which is the year that, in theory, so I, well, okay, I'm gonna, not going to take too long on this, but Hong Kong, of course, reverted from, British overseeing them into China's hands in 1997. I think most people historically understands that. And technically, they have until 2046 before like the communist Chinese mainland Ch Communist Party takes over their government, right? I don't know if you know that, but that's
No, I didn't know that, but
very high
that's
level.
really
That's what it's
interesting.
supposed to be. That's supposed to be in there. Of course, if you are paying attention to the news, that's why there are news articles saying there are now laws in place where the mainland Chinese sort of government is already not adhering to that and kind of already taking over Hong Kong rule and stuff like that. So it's supposed to remain as is. Like, don't touch it until 2046. It's supposed to be the rule. You know what I mean? And that's why people were just crying foul and saying how it's violation of human rights, etc. But honestly, my personal opinion is like the moment in 1997 it took over, it wouldn't have lasted long anyways, in my opinion. It's like that was a good thought, 2046, but it's like
Well, yeah, now we're like 20 years away from that. I
right,
mean,
but
well,
either
you know what
way,
I
it's
mean.
like it's China and Chinese Communist Party. They're not gonna care about some arbitrary 2046 rule. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, oh yeah, I respect that rule. Anyway, so the movie actually is about some of the fears about that whole transition, hence the whole sort of number 2046 and Hong Kong filmmaker and stuff. He's actually not, I don't think he's a native, he's from Beijing originally or somewhere. But anyways, great film. It's the last movie where he's frequently collaborating with a cinematographer called Christopher Doyle, who is, I think, an American that is basically now expat. He's kind of living abroad everywhere now and making movies. He's one of the greatest cinematographers out there with Roger Deakins nowadays, working, I think, still working. So anyways, it's beautiful looking movies, all of his. I think it's the last collaboration, and after that, and then like next two movies, they some I haven't found out the story why, but they don't really work with each other anymore. So anyways, that's what I've been watching. It's a tremendous filmography still, and that's one of the great piece of film if you're into that stuff. All
What
right.
was what turned you on to just watching it just because of the unique aesthetic?
Yeah, it's one of those things I wanted to get to, but it's also for a project too that I'm not ready to announce yet, but eventually I will get to. That's okay. All right, so let's keep moving forward here. Let's dive into the feature itself, which is D.W. Griffith's 1916 Intolerance. This is about something like 2.5 or 3.5 hour or something like that movie, something like that.
Yeah, when I first read our text message, I was like, what? I almost wanted to talk to you about, like, did I read this wrong? Because I wasn't thinking Intolerance was that long. I thought it was a typo, like, oh, I can see like 2 or 1.5, like 3.
That's what? why I said, you know, you were like, yeah, I should watch this. I was like, do you really though?
Cause, do I really?
Yeah, like, you know, 3.5 hours. Do you really?
Oh, man. D.W. Griffith loves them long takes. There weren't even long takes, just long movies.
Yeah. So he made shorts in the Biograph days when he was a young buck sort of starting out in filmmaking. But after he got sort of getting into features, graduate, and that's what happens to a lot of filmmakers of those days, is that you would go from shorts, just like Buster Keaton did, and you graduate, quote unquote, from sort of so honing your directing skills in the short movies, and then you take your skills and kind of passed forward or paid forward or however you use that term to sort of work on feature films, and then pretty much you typically don't turn back anymore once you're in proper feature sort of roles as a director. So that's essentially what he's done, is that he graduated from Biograph shorts into obviously Birth Nation, and then he did this and on. He would just be making features, I think. I haven't really read through his entire filmography, so I'm not 100% sure. Sometimes people do revert back to shorts. It's not out of the ordinary, but typically filmmakers of this stature typically would do that. But all right, so what did you think of this tremendously long movie? 3.5 hours.
Well, I know where Buster Keaton got the idea for his film, The Three Ages. So there exactly. We go. I didn't hate it. I wouldn't say I loved it. But
oh, we should do a quick synopsis. Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
I always forget this part. Not always, but often. How do I even talk about the plot? So
they said it's like this. It's 4 corresponding stories. Exactly. Yeah.
So instead of the Three Ages, which is what Buster Keaton did for the sake of a shorter movie, which is a homage to this movie. It's kind of a satire of this movie. Intolerance. In Intolerance, there's 4 separate storylines. There is a modern story between a sort of boy and a girl story, kind of, essentially, and what happens to them after they're pushed out of work and they're kind of down under their luck, and how they kind of find each other again after they, you know, go through some tough times. The guy gets into some of the underworld gangster lifestyle, as it were, and there's some struggles ensues, and ultimately, you know, he was accused of murder, and he got ultimately redeemed at the end. And that's story one. Story two is ancient Babylon, the fall of Babylon, basically, is the whole story of the empire, specifically of the between Prince Belshazzar of Babylon and also Cyrus the Great of Persia, who was taking over that. And the third one is the Renaissance French story, where it basically talks about so the first story takes place roughly 1914, around the story of when the film takes place. The second of Babylon, fall of Babylon, is 539 BC roughly, and the third one is the Renaissance French around 1572, I think, 16th century, and it talks about the Saint Bartholomew's Day, which is the massacre of Protestant Huguenots by Catholic royals. And then the fourth and final story is the biblical Judean story of this Christ and his leading up to his crucifixion, essentially, of 2780 roughly. So That's the four intertwining stories. They're not told sequentially one after the other. They're intercut. Just like the Three Ages, which is kind of taking off of this. And just like, I think, even when we talked about it in that podcast, about a modern equivalent would be like Cloud Atlas, the Tom Hanks movie. There's probably others, but that's the one I can think of off the top of my head because I have seen that movie. There may be others. I haven't researched. I don't really know.
Yeah, I was thinking about the Cloud Atlas when I was watching this as well, but that's one I'm going to have to watch now just because of, you know, now we've watched three movies with the same concept. So I'm like, I got to see this.
Yeah, and the conceit behind it is that there are themes in each of the separate stories that might potentially speak to one another across the time periods is essentially what it's kind of talking about. And so anyway, sorry to interrupt. So continue your thoughts about Intolerance.
Yeah, it was like just saying, didn't love it, didn't hate it, but besides the fact it's long. I mean, cinematography wise, very cool. Costume design, also pretty nice. I liked the Babylonian era. The French was pretty fancy. What else did I love about it? I finally got to, so there's like two parts to this movie, when we watch it on Canopy. So the main, like the most famous shot from this film is looking down on the Babylonian, city. And then it just slowly pans down into it, which is really cool. And that's what people reference usually when they talk about Intolerance, this one shot. But I thought it was going to be at the very beginning of the film itself. I was surprised it was in the second act and kind of a little ways in. I don't know. It's like with this film, I felt as if, because there were the four corresponding stories once again, and they weren't with the same actors, I don't think. Am I wrong? Were all the same actors playing similar roles in each section? I don't think so. Not this time.
Not this time. Yeah, they are separate, pretty sure.
Okay, I was trying to find faces like with the Three Ages to see if it was similar, but no. I couldn't really just care for anybody. Right. I think the people I most related to were like their titles were like the little wife or the dear one. It's the same woman.
Right.
And the boy, which is her husband. I felt kind of the most not even connected. I cared the most about their situation because it's during Prohibition and the wife's husband gets, oh God, he gets sent to jail, and then her baby's sick while he's in jail, so he didn't even know he had a baby. And she's like, you know, back then, let's try some whiskey. And then these stupid women for Prohibition, these feminist ladies with their stupid hats and their stupid faces come in. They're like, we're taking your baby. And I'm like, okay, no. And then you don't even know what happens to the baby at the end. It just stays in like a shelter. Oh, that made me mad. But I couldn't even just really describe Intolerance. I mean, I love words, I love language, but I still had to look up what the word intolerance meant because, you know, just thinking of it as its standalone, dictionary word, I'm like, I don't know, I can't describe it. But intolerance means the unwillingness to accept views, beliefs, or behavior that differ from one's own, which is like, okay, I understand that part of the film now and why everybody was kind of arguing with each other in one respect. But still, it's like, I mean, I guess it kind of correlates to now, just as it will throughout time, whether it's the Black Lives Matter movement or, you know, the issues you were just mentioning in China, where China's not, you know, they don't really care about the 2047 rule, you know? Yeah, do you have any comment on that? 2046, excuse me.
So, absolutely. Those are all very, it's about any and all of those points, essentially.
Yeah.
So, you know, my take on this is my relationship to this movie is like, I think the last time I've seen this was, oh, and by the way, we're so into this podcast now, but Bob is going to be out until next week, so he'll rejoin us next week.
Okay.
I think things that we should be talking about at the top of the hour, I'm just slowly peppering it in.
Oh, man. I like that, though. He just, like, throw it in there.
It feels like amateur hours sometimes. But anyways, getting back to the movie, the last time I remember watching this is probably, you know, like early 2000s, you know, when I was going through D.W. Griffith's filmography. And I'm pretty sure I've seen almost all of his movies, at least the feature ones. I didn't think that the shorts were easily available in the early 2000s, at least that I was aware of. And so it may have been, but I remember that at least most of his features I've seen. And so this is just simply one of those features I've seen. And then, as well as now, and same thing with The Birth of the Nation. So in spite of whatever you think about the actual content, whether it's the racism of The Birth of the Nation or anything inside of Intolerance, the movie itself, there's his sort of technical skill is definitely there, right? So, like, you know, The Birth of the Nation is a very linear story. And so I think that that kind of plays well, if that makes sense. Right off of the popularity of The Birth of the Nation, D.W. Griffith was basically taking advantage of his fame and fortune at that time and was saying, well, you know, now that I'm here, let's kind of go for broke. His original premise was actually just to make the modern story, which is, you know, with the girl and the boy, essentially. So his original script, his idea, as it were, he didn't have actually finished script. He was just like, he just wanted to make that story about the boy and the girl, and that's it. But, you know, he really loved Italian epics. So, like, when he was watching, at that point, Quo Vadis had come out, which is a movie. Essentially, it's like a big Italian epic with, you know, casts of hundreds, if not thousands, on the screen, and sometimes there's chariots, there's horses. It's kind of like the, I don't know if you've heard the phrase sword and sandal movies, like Gladiator, you know?
I haven't heard that phrase, but it seems to, you know.
But you remember the movie Gladiator with Russell Crowe? You remember that?
Yes, I haven't watched it. There are so many movies I haven't watched.
Right. But that movie, basically, when that was, well, Gladiator specifically came out in 2000. Was a callback to a lot of biblical epics of the 1950s, like Ten Commandments, Ben-Hur. And it's the phraseology is that they have the sword and they're wearing sandals. That's the whole notion where these type of movies are entertaining because they're based on sort of epic nature of, you know, those type of movies. So long story short, Italians have been doing that for a while, and D.W. Griffith essentially got jealous. So he was like, well, if they can do it, I can do it. So in the middle of creating this modern story, he essentially started to think about what can I do to sort of make this even better than it is. And essentially he was like, I got it. I'll do this multi-thing arc. And, you know, he basically wanted to throw everything in there, and the kitchen sink is the whole reason why he started off adding all these different story threads into a single film.
Makes sense.
Yeah, so that's the whole premise and how he kind of decided on getting into this stuff. I don't think it 100% works the way that he imagined it. However, I do have to say that, like, the grandeur of it is definitely is something worthy of note, because, like, if you, especially the Babylon set, like, if you look at that set, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Like, obviously nowadays it would be done CG, but back then you saw real life people, and if it was hundreds, if not thousands of people, then there were hundreds, if not thousands of people on the screen, mm-hmm. you know, and he built like, you know, three statues, four statues aside.
Yeah, there were... was so many, there's so much detail to it. Yeah. And I mean, as someone who likes, you know, the art department side in, you know, props and whatnot, it was just like, wow. You know, that's why I mentioned it earlier too, where, you know, that scene is so epic.
It's not just like, you know, a quick shot in here and there. And they, of course, did the primary research. If you remember, I don't know if you read this chapter on the Kevin Brownlow book, The Parade Goes By, a book. But in the book, in one of the interviews or discussions, is that Griffith is a person who likes to surround himself with a lot of people. So he's not one of those people that does everything himself, but rather he surrounds himself with all sorts of people. And he kind of just more like a commander of a troop, you know? And so, and he does, and the good thing is that he likes the research. So he has a lot of people go off and do different research on how authentic we ought to be doing. Because if you look at a lot of the films at that time, they don't always pay attention to the details of research and historic significance. And so when you see those Babylonian artwork, it's based on, like, at that point in time, archaeology, what they've dug up. Of course, it's more since that time, right? Since the 1910s. But at that point, they've had a lot of research on Babylonian Assyrian days. And so they are taking what research that they had and perform primary research, and they took a lot of those archaeological museum type stuff and basically recreated that as a set, you know, what you saw in the museums. And that's why there's an air of authenticity, because people can link that. If people are a little bit educated and they're visiting museums and they're educating themselves and they can look at drawings or pictures, they're like, wow, at the very least, even if you didn't like any of the stories or anything, you can tell that a serious research, primary research has been done, and they try to replicate the actual look. And the same applies to the French stories in terms of their costuming and the sets and what kind of the kind of swords that they were using and the kind of fighting techniques or whatever. And, you know, same with the crucifixion of Christ, on and on and on. So all those things are, there are a lot of details in there. So, you know, just like the Birth of a Nation, all those technical pieces, the sets, the costumes, the special effects, the lighting, and, you know, this is cinematographer Billy Bitzer. Now, there's a famous Arthur Lenning, or Lemming, I forgot his spelling of his name, but he is a biographer of D.W. Griffith. It's actually an interview on YouTube, which we should probably link in the show notes. But in the 8 or 9 part sort of interview, he talks about the fact that Bitzer was not an artistic person, but he would get all the technical, he was a cameraman work correct. Remember, this is still the time where people's roles weren't like totally divided as it is now, like producer, director. So he's basically the cameraman. So he'll technically know how to operate the camera, but he was actually not an artistic person. And so he just, you know, if a setup is good and it's efficient, that's all he really cares about. But if like D.W. Griffith is like, wow, that shot's really artistic and it looks really nice, it's just like,
he just goes with it.
Looks nice. And he'll just kind of take sort of that. So that's kind of how they made all these movies, which is kind of
interesting. And
yeah,
funny.
It explains why some of those, and I think the person being interviewed, the biographer, did mention that if you look at editing, how editing should be done, is that, you know, if you have a wide shot, a close-up shot, and a medium shot, when you cut between all of those things, they should somehow be in sync, right? So like if a person starts to get up, if you cut to a close-up, you should be the timeline has progressed a little bit, right? Or, and then if he sits down again or shakes somebody's hand from left to right, your camera should be following those actions. Well, if you pay attention to this and many of his other movies, they leave too many frames on. So you would show often the person getting up 2 or 3 times between cuts, when they cut between a medium shot, wide shot, close-ups, you'll just see it over and over again, just because, again, they kind of go into this haphazardly. They don't, again, a lot of things were defined as it is now, which is just shocking if you think about it, like how these things were made and how people still kind of harken back to how technically great they are or were, but it's like, except for some of these little details.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, all these continuity checks we have now, they have to be precise. And then back then, they just, you know, snip the nitrate.
They glue it. Yeah. Well, the point is they didn't really have a good sort of grasp on continuity. And so I think, and this is not based on any interviews, but from what I've read or heard, D.W. Griffith is a little bit like ADD-ish. If you were to be diagnosed today, he would be kind of that way. But some of the background information is that when he grew up, he actually attended at most a year of school, like proper schooling. But other than that, he worked in bookstores, and he would self-educate. He would read a lot of books. And this is why he loves research, just general research. And that's why all his films are very well-researched, to kind of almost compensate for the lack of, like, he didn't really go to proper schooling. You know what I mean?
Makes sense.
In his own personal life. So anyway, so that's kind of a little bit on him and how he relates to how the Intolerance movies are made. Before we kind of either finish off or keep going, I just do want to make a point, though, that, like, it's a very, like, conflicting thing, because we know that, like, the Birth of the Nation, like, there are racist elements. Even today, there are many sides of perspectives that it's a very controversial film, right? Like, there is a side or perspective that it's a movie of its time, and, like, everybody was, in fact, even that biographer in the YouTube documentary was basically saying, like, what are you talking about? Like, 99% of the people there, you know, in America at that time, 1910s, like, you know, they're just racist. I mean, that's not a good thing, but that's how people were. he's kind of like defending, like, it's like slavery, right? Everybody was doing slavery, but that's okay because that's how they were. You know what I mean? Like,
well, like in the 1800s.
But the point is, the point is that there's just a lot of problematic sort of defense of, like, you have to remember the context of the time.
Yeah.
And that makes it okay. And in some ways...
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's like a yes, no.
That's why it's complicated, right? So you have one perspective saying that, and the other perspective saying, you know, oh, you should know better. And there were protests even then, and of, you know, how the movie is depiction of... encourages, you know, Ku Klux Klan and racism. And so... The Birth of the Nation, of course, is problematic at most, right? In spite of the technical features. And in my travels, when I have chatted with other silent film sort of enthusiasts, the ones that who really know silent film history, I think will say that even if D.W. Griffith did not make The Birth of the Nation or even Intolerance, either work, that there would have been somebody, maybe of color, that would have made something like that. Like, it was only a matter of time. And the reason why the history looks back upon these works with a lot of reverence is because, one, D.W. Griffith is an incredibly efficient self-promoter. Remember some of the background I gave you, which was, like, the way he grew up was in kind of a very poor environment. He wasn't really educated. And so because of his sort of background, he always felt self-conscious about that. Does that make sense? Like, the way it shaped him as a person. And so growing up, he would always feel a sense of pride when he's making these works, right?
Yeah, because he's trying to better himself and, like,
kind
say,
of, but also, like, he
do.
Would also, like, at the end, when he's done with the biograph shorts, he actually took out an ad in one of the trade publications saying he was the first one who came with intercuts. He's first one who did editing. He's the first director who came up with the close-ups. Like, he was a self-promoter. So there's a lot of arrogance and pride in where his status was as a film director, and because other people also lavish praises upon him during his biograph short stays, as well as The Birth of the Nation and heck, even Intolerance. So throughout all these movies, people just lavish praise upon him, and he would in turn take that fame and fortune and kind of add fuel to the fire. And I think that's partially the reason why film historians, remember when we were watching the Alice Guy Blucher documentary, mm-hmm. Be Natural, mm-hmm. where all these historians just would write this film history based on hearsay, like other people's words. They would not actually talk to the interviewed, the primary resource. They had, like, they probably didn't even talk to D.W. Griffith.
Yeah.
Before just reading something about the trip, because he himself wrote it. So he's literally writing his own history.
Hmm.
So I think that's part of some of the problems with his fame and fortune and his position in film history, is that as we think as great as it is, all these other deep researchers of silent film history can tell you several examples. Now, some of these examples is not going to have within that single movie all this technique that he's just done. Like, you know, the way that Birth of the Nation had a lot of close-ups, medium shots, like all this editing to tell a linear story. Some of them have something close to that, but it's not like as refined and thrown in. And that's part of what makes D.W. Griffith the way he is. He's just like to throw everything in the kitchen sink in, you know, and almost by happy coincidence and happenings and luck, it came out that way. Same with Intolerance. And I think that's part of his sort of MO, is how he makes these movies. And I think that's part of what solidifies this position in film history. Now, since that time, we've had almost hundreds of years now, 100 plus years to not retcon, I would say, but rather see it for what it is, that he was like a self-promoter, and with The Birth of the Nation, for sort of the more race, specifically racist portions, he would not be apologetic for that, because he was basically saying, it is my perspective. Basically, he's kind of defending his racism. Like,
yeah,
that's my movie. That's my perspective. I have freedom of the press. And if you want to make your own movie, go ahead and make your own. Like, make your own theme. Make your own movie about whatever. But that's my movie for it. And in fact, Intolerance was doubling down if he was gambling on that. He was basically saying he was the one being faulted for sort of speaking his perspective and opinion, you know, in that movie, and he's the one that other people were intolerant of. Like, he's supposed to be the shining beacon of like goodness, right? Or I mean, he didn't say that, but like, he's supposed to be the person or the artist who has a perspective where other people were shunting him. So his whole premise and foundation behind why Intolerance, the movie, was made and it was titled that way, was he felt like everybody was intolerant of him in his movie and his perspective. So with that in mind, I just have a real problem with the movie starting with that mindset. Does that make sense? Like, mindset being, I made a racist movie, I'm not going to defend it, I'm going to keep going with this. And heck, everybody's like this anyways. I don't know why you're, you know, attacking me. You're being intolerant of me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's that's like a double-edged sword. I mean,
exactly.
I can agree with that because I get it, but at the same time, it's like, no, you gotta no.
Yeah.
But then
and
you
that's
my
that's problem.
2020
with it,
perspective.
Like, you know, one is that he's unrepentant in that respect, and he's made a whole movie about defending it. So this movie doesn't have all those themes, the controversial themes, except like, love and goodness, blah blah blah. All his, you know, love is subtitle is like Love Struggle Through the Ages. So he's basically saying throughout all these time periods between modern times, between Babylon, between the French sort of days, he's basically talking about how like all these people were intolerant of all these people's lifestyles, and they were intolerant of them, and he's putting himself as the main characters. You know, he is, you know, the girl and the boy while society was shunting them, right? Or in the Renaissance French story, he was sort of the Protestants, innocent, quote-unquote, Huguenot Protestants that got slaughtered by the intolerant Catholics. Or he is Jesus. Notice his pride, right, coming in. And he gets crucified by all these, you know, Pharisees, he calls it. Or in Babylon, he's this, you know, quote-unquote, good prince, ruler of this Babylon, you know, because he gave freedom to one of the, which is the Talmage sister. Which one started? I think it's Constance, the youngest Talmage sister. So she started as the mountain girl. So she's the youngest sister of the Talmage sisters, right? To Norma and Natalie. And Constance. So I think Natalie has a cameo in here too. I couldn't spot her. There's so many people. But anyways, and so he's the one that gave her that stamp. Remember in the movie where a prince...
She can marry whoever she wants
of feminism in, you know, 539 BC. And and it's the Cyrus the Great who is the evil, you know, whoever trying to topple his, you know, freedom. So I think that's part of my problem with this is that as great as some of the technical pieces are, the set pieces, the cast of thousands, the special effects, the lighting, and all of the film techniques that we modern day often will attribute to this, but the foundation behind all of that is based on a very shaky premise of like race is going to defend it, and yet hundreds of years later we still have today a lot of film historians who love to say that he's remarkable, and he is remarkable. But we're not highlighting the fact that there are many others as well who's doing, you know, similar, if not better work in some of the areas. They may not have put everything into a single film, right? There's not like a single film equivalent of like The Birth of the Nation or Intolerance. But there are many movies where these film techniques like close-ups and multiple storylines or like, you know, the cross-cuttings and all those things were being accomplished by other people, and some of them even better, you know?
Yeah, of course.
So that's my problem with this. It's this. So one is that his sort of unrepentant thing about racism, all that stuff, which is very topical today, but also two is this just massive sort of egotistic thing. Like he, you know, I am great. I'm continuing to be great. And I can do this multiple storylines and I'm going to one up the Italian, you know, epic directors. Let's show them who's going to do this better. And so that's kind of some of my conflicting feelings about it. And that's just to set it up. I haven't even dug into the actual movie story.
I know. It's funny, you know, just I had this idea too, because when we were talking about Within Our Gates, that Twitter link that I linked to it, which is originally where I found it, the lady was so sassy about comparing what D.W. Griffith was like compared to Oscar Micheaux, and just how basically D.W. Griffith would complain when he didn't get the funding for his movie, wherein it's like Oscar Micheaux just like, well, just gonna do it anyway. You know, just like he's kind of, I don't know, a wailing baby in a sense if he doesn't get his way. And I'm just like, as talking about it too, it's just like, yeah, you know, you got some struggles, but who doesn't deal with it?
It's part of his controversy. I think it's so complicated because, as all human beings are, is that any time that we have modern eyes and audiences trying to point to the fact that, you know, there are some problems with D.W. Griffith movies. You'll often hear the opposition defenders come to his aid saying, well, he's kind of like an ADD guy. And he would just grab on. He's like, you know, in the movie Up, there's a dog saying, you know, squirrel. He'll just go to the next thing. And that's kind of how he was. And the defense is that he may not have known that some of these, you know, was going to come out this way, you know, whether it's the Birth Nation or something like that.
I'm rolling my eyes just so you know.
Right. So that's a defense of like, you know, yeah, he kind of accidentally became racist. Or later on, he did another movie where it's like where the Asians are very stereotyped, right? Like there's a, I forgot the title now, but there's another movie where like it's one of those cringeworthy movies that hasn't aged well.
Oh geez. Yeah.
So he's not racist once. He's multiple times, but also like another defense of that, just like, again, that's the way the United States was. Yes, it was racist, and you kind of just have to face up to it. And also, like, he was, again, ADD. So there's a lot of these defenders of some of these filmmakers who are kind of just like that. And it's really hard to kind of get behind that sometimes, you know? So, I don't know. I'm just bringing up more, opening up more cans of worms than closing them, I guess. If you can close cans of worms.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my feelings about it, which is very conflicted, is that there are, I think, so first is, my view is definitely like a lot of people just want to kind of get rid of it. So my stand up about that is that let's not get rid of stuff. Like, you know, I'm not going to reference any modern stuff, but like so many times people just want to get rid of the offending thing, kind of the cancel culture. So I don't think that's healthy in general, because we need to have something still in place that you can reference so that we know our history so we don't repeat it, right? So that's right. One. Like, don't get rid of, you know, the Birth of a Nation or Intolerance because we know he has some race. Have people study it, like, you know, African-American studies, or, you know, whether it's Asian American studies or whatever, ex American studies, have them look at it and take it apart and figure out what is the problem with it and identify those problems, you know, make your mark by saying that, you know, that's the problem with this, you know. And it's the same thing with all works of art in the past. There are many works of art in the past where it's totally sexist and racist and whatever is. And you know what? They're still here, and we can still read it with, like, you know, like Mark
fresh,
Twain. You
not
know,
fresh eyes, but is that what you're kind of?
Yeah, what I'm saying
that?
Is that you again, like anything, study it with the proper context, so that you're not, you know, either you know, overselling it or underselling it. You just put it into place in the context of where it came out of, what was going on at that time. And so that it makes sense to you, you know? But the notion of, like, getting rid of everything offensive is not healthy either. I think if you try to scrub everything clean, there would be nothing left because everyone has flaws. It's sort of like, you know, like, you look at all your friends. They all have flaws. You know, spoiler alert.
Yes, yeah.
You know, you're going to get rid of all your friends? You know, like, you know, that's what I'm saying. It's like all these art... All the artists behind them, they all have flaws, you know, whether it's massive or small, they all have flaws. And to have that cancel culture come out and say, anytime you have a flaw, gotta get rid of it. I think you have to look at, like, how they have grown or not, right? Mm. If you look at the history of D.W. Griffith, he didn't really grow too much, you know? Mm. And so that's one of those things that, like, you have to take into context as you study his work, right? Or... let's fast forward to more modern example, like James Gunn, right? So James Gunn, I don't know if you heard the story, but he is the director of...
did Guardians of the Galaxy.
Volume 1, 2, and now 3. Well, he was fired by Disney for a while because he had all these, like, pedophilic, really offensive tweets from way back in the day when he was young. But that was, like, 5-10 years ago, you know? And, again, I am not defending it. It's probably atrocious and terrible. I don't think I remember reading it, but, like, you know, all that stuff, it's like, because of social media, everything's now there, you know. But if you remember back, at least I still grew up in an era where before social media, there was a lot of dumb stuff I did as a kid that if it wasn't social media, I'd be in trouble for, you know.
Yeah.
And that's everyone, you know. And I think they were right in kind of getting him back because they know that that was... something that he was doing as part of his shtick, you know, as the in the Twitter world and stuff like that, and so in the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
But again, long story short is that cancel culture, when you're trying to get rid of stuff without actually knowing the context, it can be a little bit dangerous, because the funny thing is you're becoming sort of the fascism, Nazism type person that you're trying to get rid of, right? The whole point of like Nazi fascism people is like they want to get rid of people they don't agree with, right? That's the whole premise behind it. And yet if you are the cancel culture and you're like, well, I don't want to get rid, I don't want those people around, you're becoming them, you know? Like, who's right? Who's the person that should be the arbiter of truth and justice? You know what I mean? So
yeah,
that's I think there's some context that, again, context is king, right? You got to figure out what's going on with the context, and even though you don't like it, have that's kind of the founding sort of thing of America, is that we allow, even if it's totally offensive, right, like Nazis to exist, or else we've outlawed Nazis. You can't be a Nazi, right? But wait a minute, that law is Nazi-istic.
Double-edged sword. That's what I'm saying.
So anyway, totally sidetrack and tangent now. Let's get back into Intolerance, the movie. So that's kind of the overshadowing thing that I have with this feature. But having said all of that, that's kind of that taints it, I think. Like, as much as I want to affirm and praise and lavish this movie for all of its technical stuff, all of that stuff I just said, I think is worth saying because it taints the whole experience. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like,
sorry,
if it hidden any of those things, I think I would have even not talked about it and just moved on to just like the technical stuff. Then would have been like how great he was and da da da, you know. Like, we're gonna do we're gonna tackle some of like the F.W. Murnau movies. Again, he was not a perfect human being either. But boy, you know, compared to this guy, he's kind of a saint. So, like, with him, I'll focus more on his movies and his techniques and his technical stuff and his artistry and, you know, all that good stuff. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, do you remember specific, getting back into the movie itself, do you remember specific things from the movie that really popped out at you, like, in bold, in terms of technical things or story structure or things that you remember?
Just the main thing is that shot going into Babylon. Yeah. That's probably the most impressive one. There was the one of the young mother, the little deer, whatever her name is. I think it was either her or the other woman. They did this super extreme close-up and the camera moved up to her. That was kind of surprising to see. Not that it was in focus.
It's the other girl, the killer.
Okay, it is the killer.
Yeah.
I know I've seen a clip of it paused on that same woman, too, where she has a tear in her eye.
Right.
That's just like a random screen grab I've seen from Intolerance, but I don't really know the importance of that part. I mean, she's repenting for being the reason that she killed her husband during the squabble where her husband's going after the other woman, and then her husband comes in, then she gets shot, he gets shot. It's just a mess, and which is why the boy, the husband, gets arrested, because the cops just happen to be there, right, which in reality, they never are.
Yeah. Well, that's all the nature of kind of the melodrama type thing that he himself, D.W. Griffith, was a little ex machina type plot points that he's very famous for. Also, like, the whole drumming the action up towards the end and saving people the last minute. Almost all his movies have that, too.
Mm.
But, I think the whole point of that is because this is that character, that girl. First of all, you have to remember, I think I don't know if her parents or somebody died during the first strike. So the workers strike, and then there are people who the capitalists, they call it, would shoot them, the people who were on strike, and would kill them. And so some of them would lose their jobs, and that's the whole point, is that they have to move on. And so that girl ended up nowhere and basically fell into a life of prostitution, I think is the intention behind that. And so and the villain there in this, the modern storyline, is kind of like the pimp who was sending this the boy with the gun and going on errands and doing stuff. So I think because the boy showed her kindness during when they both escaped from the original strike, that she remember his kindness is why she decided to confess to the killing. So that she's not putting somebody like that, you know, being killed and hung, and her guilt was overwhelmed. And that scene with the whole weird camera angle where she's really close to the camera, and it actually looks like a horror shot. I don't know. That reminded me of a horror movie shot. But anyways, that whole scene and tear and everything, the whole point is that she feels this tremendous guilt. And unfortunately, it's like she's just a byproduct of capitalistic people, you know, like the manager who's cutting costs, 10% cut to all the workers' wages, and then afterwards they go on strike, you know. So that's what the movie's trying to show you, is that as a result of economic problems, this girl or woman has to find a means to work as prostitute, but then squeezed to the limits, she shoots and kills her pimp, and she's kind of the, you know, tragic figure of that storyline because of her circumstances, of which she has nothing to do with. She ends up being the killer, you know. That's her tragedy, you know. So and her killing the pimp person is really more about saving the boy, you know. It wasn't really just killing for the sake of killing. So at least that's true. That's at least supposed to be the way. But again, this is just like very melodramatic anyways. So it doesn't take on to a more dramatic, more sort of real stakes drama, as it were, as other type of filmmakers that come out. Now, that capitalism and strike concept, remember we watched the movie Strike?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Russians really love this segment. So anyways, actually, so Debbie Griffith, in order to recoup money, because he spent so much money that even though he made money, the money basically broke even or less, he ended up recutting the movie so that the modern storyline was released as its own movie in 1919.
Okay, I could see that, just because, well, once you take it away from the, you know, the other three storylines, it might, right. I don't know. I think just because...
Yeah, it's called The Mother and the Law, 1919 right here.
Ugh. Having everything, correlate just like that is just, it's too much. I don't know how these people did it back then. I know they would have breaks in between, but still, it's just three-hour-long movies.
I think that he was ahead of his time. I think that the audiences of 1916... I can't really digest that. It was far too ahead of its time because they haven't had a chance with anything else, anything like it, you know. And nowadays we have so much, right? We have so many, we have decades of cinematography, movie experiences now, where these multi-threaded storylines it's okay. It's like we can handle it now, you know, like when Cloud Atlas came out. I mean, that was already hundreds of years after the fact, you know? And so we as the audience, I think, culturally can actually accept that and comprehend that as much as we can, you know what I mean? But even then, like, not everybody likes that. It's a very artsy movie, you know? And so The Birth of a Nation was like a blockbuster more, whereas Intolerance was more like more artsy than the audiences were used to. And that's why he kind of recouped money. He recut that as The Mother and the Law in 1919. And then he also did The Fall of Babylon. He extracted all the Babylon scenes out as his own separate movie. So that's what happened. So, yeah, it had mixed reviews when it came out, so not everybody liked it. But some people liked it. I don't know. It had mixed reviews back then. But so anything else? I'll give you a list of what I thought what that stood out this time around for me. This would be either the second or third time watching this for me, but all of the big epic scenes, you know, were just as epic as I remember them. This is kind of like that 1916s version of stuff like the Lawrence Arabia. Huge, tremendous epics.
Yes, I did get that vibe when I watched that part.
Yeah, or the Ten Commandments or any of those huge, tremendous epic movies where, you know, especially if you watch it on a projector, big screen, you'll see all those people flitting about. And I don't think they still even have made any movies like this still, you know, like cast of hundreds of thousands with sets, extensions that go crazy. I mean, things that they're doing in the silent film era, not just him, but others, like,
they can't afford that now. I mean, they all have to be on the budget.
And yeah, Cecil B. DeMille himself did a version of the Ten Commandments in silent movie, and he built like real life-size, like Egyptian-type, you know, props and sets, and that was just as expansive and large and expensive as this one. So they're all trying to up one another, you know, and so that's kind of huge. I would say, It just goes on and on, you know. When you watch this movie, it's just like, it's incredible. The other thing is, like, some of the lighting is pretty interesting in this movie. Like the Mary, the Virgin Mary rocking the baby. There's a light shaft coming from the top. So that's pretty cool idea. There's another scene towards the end when he's on the death row, the boy. And the priest is giving his last rites, and he's looking up. You can see the light reflected in his eyeballs, like at the screen. So if the camera is on a close up of the actor, let me get his name. I'm gonna forget the boy, Robert Heron. So he's looking up at the screen as if looking up at heaven, and if he's looking, his eyes is looking up, and the camera's on a close up. Inside of his eyes, you could see the light reflecting off of his eyeballs. Like, that's a great, you know, again, probably happening stance. Like, oh, yeah, you think that's great? Yeah, I'll do more of that. But that's one of those happy quints. And also, I think that he had help. There was another cameraman person who's not credited on, or maybe it is, I don't know for sure, but I forgot his name now, but he's the one that's more artistic and is kind of helping things plot along that way. So it may have been him more than the Billy Pitzer guy. So those are kind of the two highlights. And I know it's a really long movie, but that's kind of what I remember seeing here. The most effective storylines were the modern storyline and then the Fall of Babylon storyline. You know, Constance Talmadge is great. The mountain girl who would just take no crap, you know. So she's great there in that Fall of Babylon story. The French story wasn't as effective, I don't think. And neither was the Christ story element.
I think the French story was just too short, you know, even though.
It's the same with the Christ story, too.
Again, they just kind of threw him in there.
Trying to tie all these themes together. But it's almost like if you cut those, even if you took those two out, it would still be okay. I think it's like people wouldn't miss a thing. He's just trying to be more artistic by tying all these different themes together, you know. That's his shtick. So
yeah, because that's one thing I couldn't really figure out myself, because like if Jesus was around during the Babylonian era, but I think he was before.
Oh, they're different times. So you could one.
Yeah,
of
that's
them
what
is,
I wasn't sure because
yeah, they're different times. Yeah. So one's 539 BC, one's 27 AD, and then the French one was 1572, and the other one's modern time, modern to then 1914. So
okay, so yeah,
different times.
Because I know they mentioned, you know, they have those slates with the. I'm assuming it was Jewish writing or something on it at one point. So, you know, that would be Israel. I wasn't sure. I was like, sorry, my brain's getting tired again.
Yeah, that's all right.
But
that's really the highlight I have. And the only thing that I can remember being discussed in some of the behind the scenes stuff is that the during the strike scene for the modern story time, do you remember so first of all, to clarify a few things, the feminist group wasn't really a feminist group. They came from a group that is labeled the Uplifters.
Yeah.
The Uplifters is like a more high class club of like rich people. That's essentially what the Uplifters are. They're not actually a feminist thing. And even when the film came out, there are groups who are claiming that D.W. Griffith was sexist because he's basically equating these Uplifters as feminist groups and also saying that they're like Pharisees. They're like negative. They're not good people and they're trying to inflict their views. So that's not what he's saying. I think what he's trying to say is the Uplifters, if you lived in that time, the 1915-ish era, you would have known that the Uplifters is a social club of rich upper, super high upper class, uppity ups. And it's almost like, I can't even think of any equivalents today, but like, you know,
like
Silicon
in
Valley
a yacht club. I don't know.
Yeah, whatever. So some rich club type people, and it's actually mostly men. So that's the only thing that he spun at its head a little bit. He made it like a female version of that, which in my research, I don't know for sure, but in my research, it didn't really exist that I could find. So the Uplifters, the name signifies a male only club. There's no women allowed in it. But there weren't any women only Uplifter type clubs, like using that Uplifter name. So he kind of was using that to basically, at least I'm guessing, to just inflict intolerance upon the dear one, saying how she was a bad mother, took the mother away, was kind of, they're kind of representative and symbolic of something else in society, of moralistic / religious, very uptight type people, you know? So I don't think they're representing like the feminist movement or anything like that. That is a subtext that might not be there, right?
Yeah.
So
it's kind of, because I mean, yeah, besides subtext, it's, you know, you have to know the context of that time period too with who the Uplifters were. So that's probably why I didn't really get their point. I just figured they're like, you know, feminist prohibition ladies who just, I don't know, like, you know, you see them in a bad light. You don't see any good qualities in their characters because really they're not portrayed that way. They're just portrayed as like ruining lives.
Kind of a symbol or representative of like all society's judgments on the boy and the dear one and how they're living their lives. It's kind of their representing symbolism. But rewinding a little bit into that capitalist person, so the premise is that there's a guy who's running a factory and he has a sister, and his sister is the one who is in the Uplifter Club, and she is donating a lot of money by asking him to donate money. So his sister is the one that's convincing her brother, who's the owner of this factory, to donate a lot of money to power these Uplifter clubs, to have their sort of moralistic, pharisaic,
okay, sort
of like ideas, right? That's the whole plot point. Now, he is actually supposed to be representative of Rockefeller. So D.W. Griffith really disliked people who are trying to make slaves, I guess, out of these workers. And that's why, like, if you were from that time, you would have seen that there was actually a real life event. I forgot the name now, but there's a real life event around the time these movies were made. And if you were watching this, you would immediately have known that it was Rockefeller, and he was trying to tighten up wages for capitalism reasons. And people went on strike, and then the National Guard or people, both the government officials as well as the company people, actually shot and killed a bunch of people who were on strike.
Okay, yeah, because that's what happens in the movie. So exactly,
right.
They're
so that
correlating.
It was basically like a one-to-one dig. And when he hired the actor almost looked like Rockefeller too, has a likeness to him. And also like, and one little clinch point, like the thing that clinches the whole thing is like the, when he saw a penny, and he picked it up or whatever coin. I don't know if it's a penny, but that money.
Oh, yeah,
on the floor.
That other guy. He was like working for the Rockefeller character, and he just, but he was looking at the girl and I don't know. That sucks.
Well, no, he is the Rockefeller guy. He is the kind of the boss guy. He picked up the coin. He was inspecting out the party. He was like, oh, these guys are partying until 10, and they should be in bed and ready for work tomorrow, right?
Oh, okay. I thought it was two different characters.
Yeah, so he picks up a coin, and he shines it. He's like, oh, put it in his pocket. And that's Rockefeller's kind of story, is that he says his wealth begins with the first coin or whatever he picked up. So, like, again, it's a totally a whole like thing about like how, you know, capitalism has overtaken. Remember, this is post like industrial age, right? So he's making a huge criticism about he would have probably known about like Updike and all the criticisms about the jungle, you know, ideas and stuff like that.
So, yeah, anyways. Very, very interesting. I mean, now that we're actually, you know, really digging into intolerance, there's so many different things in this movie. But like you said, just throw it all in the kitchen sink. I mean, yeah, you could have just had the modern period as a film itself, and if you expanded on it, people would probably have gone nuts. But
well, that's why he recut it later to recoup costs.
So. Yeah, very cool.
That's really, I think, all I had. I didn't sit down and had some extensive stuff. I mean,
no, I didn't have time to look up any notes.
Yeah,
just
finishing the movie was a task on itself.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I had it on like 1.5 speed to kind of get through it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because once again, I was like, oh, this is 3.5 hours. Oops, because I actually watched it earlier today.
It's almost like a Netflix series you have to binge through, you know?
I know, and I don't even binge Netflix. Last thing I watched was like when the virus started, I think back in March. And I finished it in like 2 days, like some anime series. Woo.
So anyways, that's my take on it. The intolerance, it's a great technical achievement, and it still is. It's not the first per se. There are a lot of, again, Italian epics that have done similar things, and as well as many other filmmakers and artists that also have done very similar things in terms of the scope and the themes, but not all of it in a single film. So I guess that's the one sort of unique feature of his on this film, and talking multiple storylines, all trying to say something, but I don't think 100% successfully.
Yeah.
Because it's just, Too long. It's just way too long. It's one of those situations where he's an artist and he got famous, and then nobody wants to cut him, right? Nobody's gonna produce this film and be like, hey, Griffith, this is too long. It's not making sense, and you gotta cut it down. So nobody's telling him no. It's a typical artist situation where, you know, you get popular, you get famous, and all of a sudden, like,
you got big britches too.
Yeah, and nobody can tell you no now he's, you know, so that's the excess. So it has, you know, its problems. In summary, like I already said, it has these foundational problems of his perspective and view of why he's making it and calling it intolerance, you know, of his problematic views.
Ugh.
So that I think overshadows some of the artistic thing. That's not to say it isn't skillful. It is. It's just I just have a hard time reckoning both, right? So
yeah,
myself personally.
I mean, it's like if you were gonna recommend one of the other movie to people, yeah, I'd just be like, I don't know.
Yeah, I think he's done other movies. He's done stuff like his shorts are pretty good, and there are other movies after this, Orphan something, that one's pretty good. The something Broken Blossom. Oh, that is the one with the
Broken Blossoms. That's with Lillian Gish, I think.
Yeah, well, there most of them are. I mean, a lot of them are Lillian Gish, but that is the one with the Chinese racism one. Maybe I can't remember now. But anyway, so there's a number of stories that he's done, and I think that it's more straightforward and linear and less crazy. So he goes on to make more movies after this. So, but less crazy. I think this is the straw that broke the camel's back for him. He just got way too ambitious. And that really came to bite him afterwards. And he kind of stopped doing this, and he can't anymore because nobody's going to allow him to spend all this money anymore, you know?
Yeah. Do you know how long this took to film? Does it say in the notes?
He started working on it right after
Birth of a Nation, so that's 15. But that doesn't mean it wasn't...
Well, probably 14. That's when he started making this. I don't know. I gotta look that up.
I don't know. I don't want to say, like, almost feel like it's not a full year, but at least it's got to be at least that, because you got to build everything, especially for that scene. And make sure it's all stable, because, you know, they built not the castle walls, but they built walls, and then those things to make the, like, the towers, they reminded me of, like, the Trojan horse, but they were square horses. Yeah, so that alone, I mean, depending on how many men you can hire to build it, you know, correctly, that's at least a month, or if not longer. I don't know.
Yeah, it's the record keeping is also challenging just in general. So I'm not sure. I don't know how long it took for him to make this. Maybe other books and stuff like that.
I'd probably say in his biography.
I don't know if I would trust this biography, because like many artists of that time, they often treat it as just making things up. They don't remember a lot of details. So it's not like a very detail-oriented work. So, yeah, I don't know. Some of these books might have details on how long it took the production to make. My guess is at least a couple of years. It's got to be at least more than that, because they couldn't have cobbled together all those things so quick. The battle scenes were also pretty crazy too.
It reminds me a
lot of the modern battle scenes when they're doing sort of classical style, you know, battles and stuff. So like Lord of the Rings. It reminds me of that.
Oh yeah.
A little bit with the battle ramp.
That did remind me. This movie did remind me of Lord of the Rings, probably because of how much longer it was. But yeah. I mean, Lord of the Rings is pretty. It's pretty good. You don't have to be a nerd to appreciate those movies. Exactly. They're really good.
Well, that's all I got on Tolerance. I know more probably could be done in a scene by scene breakdown, but I don't know if I was quite into that because of those problems I've had with it. And so, yeah, I just have a very conflicted feeling and view about this movie and just relationship with D.W. Griffith as in films. So, so anyways, all right. Any parting thoughts from you?
Not so much the movie, but I did want to mention the thing I talked about earlier. So for our viewers, a friend of mine's brother recently died along with his cat and dog. So in the show notes, we'd appreciate it if you'd think about considering donating to their family for his funeral. I know he wasn't into silent films, but I think he was a film buff. So anything that could go towards his funeral or burial, however they do it, it would be really helpful and appreciated, even if it's just a dollar, because they're really hurting because it was such a freak circumstance. So thank you in advance if you're able to donate, and possibly share the GoFundMe link. It's at http://gf.me/u/yfd95f. And once again, that'll be linked in our show notes. Thank you.
Yes, thanks for putting that in there. And then anything else?
Intolerance. I don't know. That's all I got. I mean, learned a lot more about Griffith this way. It's like, once again, did I hate it? No. Did I love it? No. I guess intolerance is really an experience. Because of how grand it is. That's really how you can call this movie. It's a grand scale. Everything in it is lavish. It's grand. You look at it, you're like, wow. Especially for certain scenes. Acting's pretty good. You know, for the time period, you can tell it's still like the theater actions. And other times it's kind of more subtle, but it's definitely worth a watch. Maybe if you have a full free day and you're willing to spend that time to watch it. but just if you can, be aware of the context of the film and see why intolerance is the way it is.
All right. And that wraps up our podcast today. And once again, you can find more of our stuff at watchingsilentfilmsplural.wordpress.com. Again, it's watchingsilentfilmsplural.wordpress.com. And also send us an email if you have thoughts, comments, ideas at watchingsilentfilmsplural@gmail.com. And that'll be all for today. Thank you, Lily. Thank you, listeners.
Thanks, Yifeng.